Morning, everyone. You see the title there, and there are actually two parts to this, one dealing with organic molecules and the other dealing with nanoscale systems. So I have two goals. One is to try to look at materials in real time. I'm not looking so much at the theory that was discussed last week, but an application of more or less conventional codes. But what we want to do is go beyond linear response and beyond the harmonic approximation in various cases. So part one is basically real-time PDDFT for nonlinear response. And it's a technique which has been added to the Siesta code by real-time evolution techniques. And the second time is, well, back to my real space, real-time method for X-ray spectra. And there we use VAS plus real space codes. So first, how do we do nonlinear optical response? Well, what we're interested in, at least the group in chemistry and material science at University of Washington, has a big NSF grant to develop organic photonic systems for reasons that I'll discuss. These are fairly large optically active molecules, and as a result, they're sort of difficult to handle computationally, at least by any kind of standard techniques. There are too many states. So we've tried to develop a strategy based on real-time techniques, and it's an extension of a method that has been applied to linear response. PDDFT, and that was developed by Richard Martin and Argyrios Solikidis and Sanchez Portal of the Siesta group. And we basically inherited their code and have been developing it. Okay, well, here's the motivation. In this organic photonic systems, they try to make these little devices using organic molecules, and to control them, they can apply voltages. And the quantity that they're looking at is this electro-optic coefficient. It's basically the change in optical response to an applied voltage, and taking advantage of this nonlinearity to, control things in these junctions, modulators, et cetera, et cetera. The thing is that organic molecules have this great promise because their electric optic coefficient is 10 to 20 times higher than it is in inorganic materials. So that's the motivation. Our approach has been written up. It's described in this JCP of 2007. And how does it work? Okay, so first of all, I'm going to briefly outline the approach we use to get these nonlinear polarizabilities. If you expand the polarization in a power series in the electric field, that's how it looks, of course. And we're interested in the second order terms in this talk, E squared terms, but we're doing it at finite frequency. And so there are various combinations of frequencies that come in. You can either add or subtract omega 1 and omega 2. So there are various phenomena that you treat. One is second harmonic generation, the other is optical rectification, and if you go up in the nonlinear series, of course, you can get even higher harmonics. Okay, well, that's the frequency space picture. As I said, we want to try to do it in real time, and we're using an approach that was recommended by Yabana and Birch. And it's basically direct numerical integration of the Schrodinger equation, we start from just Cohn-Sham. You could go further, and so the degrees of sophistication in the theory are what you put into that exchange correlation term. So for starters, we used something standard off the shelf called PVE. Why not? For starters. And okay, anyway, what we want to do is apply an external field, weak external field, but of varying size, and that's just the dipole term. And then we, when we calculate these wave functions, we can get the charge density and hence the polarization as a time-dependent response. So just stepping along, and everything, we can get everything from P of T. Okay, so we calculate these wave functions, actually all the occupied states, at each time step. These are now 25 at a second time steps. So it's pretty short, but we can go pretty far with it. Well, we can use various exchange correlation potentials. Anyway, again, it's this siesta code, and it's actually quite efficient. That's the reason we did it, and can be used to handle fairly large systems. So our extension is basically to run that code at each time step. By the way, the talk was produced by my grad student, now postdoc, so yeah, I don't usually put in all those flashy things. Yes?
So if I understand you correctly, for every time step you minimize the energy functional according to the Cohn-Sham recipe.
That's right.
So this is an adiabatic approximation.
Right. However, you don't have to go so far as to really do a minimum. You can start at the last minimum, and you know it's pretty efficient to get to the next one.
Sure. But in the end, every step you minimize the functional at that time step.
Right? With that time-dependent Hamiltonian, that's right.
All right. So it is an adiabatic approximation, right?
Yes.
Yeah. But it's only adiabatic for the exchange and correlation. It's fully time-dependent because of the time-dependent Cohn-Sham equation.
Yeah, we have time. Well, it's time-dependent response. Yeah, the VXC though is adiabatic.
Just following the minimum of the energy.
Oh, I see. So it's the exchange correlation. It's the same as ALDA, basically.
Yeah. Okay, but this is how we do it. We're supposed to be solving these, and Siesta uses this non-orthogonal basis. So we actually, our coefficients, and this is a vector, involve the overlap matrix inverse and the Hamiltonian. And then we use this so-called Crank-Nicholson operator to go from time step T to time step delta T. So this is unitary, and by evaluating the Hamiltonian at the midpoint, it's very nearly time reversible. And with those two criteria, we can make really large time steps and keep it stable. Okay, and as I said, we're using PBE. So this is Crank-Nicholson. We tried various other games to play with this, and I know Hardy Gross has looked at it too, and we're sort of following his logic. Okay, so let's first do the review how you do the linear response and then go to nonlinear. So for linear response, the we subtract off a static dipole if there is one. That can be expressed in terms of a response function times an electric field, and of course keeping the time dependence there. The normal thing to do is Fourier transform both parts, and so the response function is just the ratio of the induced polarization to the applied field, and that's called the polarizability alpha of omega. And if alpha is small, then we can get the linear dielectric function by that formula, or you can put in some local field corrections. Okay, so how does it work? we've played with a couple different types of response functions. One is to use just the delta function. The other is to use a step function. And
so here's modeling some molecule in vacuum?
Yeah, this is just CO, just for a game, just to show you how it works. Response of CO to an applied pulse. And the thing rings like crazy as we go along. Okay, so obviously the dipole polarization that you get differs for these two. But the cool thing is that if we do the Fourier transform, I don't think you can tell the difference. I mean, it's really amazing. So, that's what it should be if it's linear. Shouldn't matter what the response is. Okay, and you can get the imaginary part too. So we can get both real and imaginary parts, and it satisfies some rules and agrees with experiment. Anyway, the linear response is quite good with this technique, and it's not even clear we have to go beyond ALDA for at least some small molecules. Big molecules, another story. Yes?
Is this the same answer you would get if you did simple particle excitations and Kramers-Heisenberg?
Kramers-Heisenberg.
Well, ordinary. I guess we call it RPA formula for alpha.
This is RPA DFT, right? Or RPA.
So it's DFT. If you do DFT, you calculate ground state and excitation energies. You calculate your dipole matrix elements to your excited states. You sum them up in the usual way.
Oh, you mean linear response, just sum over states?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's equivalent to sum over states.
It's exactly
the same. But, okay. You have to put an FXC, to match your results.
Right.
There is a modification of FXC here that's included. The ALD FXC is included here.
Right. So it's not quite RPA, but it's, anyway, it's RPA, it's DFT.
And so the positions of the resonances suffer from exactly the same limitations that excited states do.
Well, they're as good as TD-DFT gives them, you know? So, they will suffer. Well, I mean, that's why people are playing all these games with other kernels.
I guess I'm being stupid.
So I was.
I don't fully understand the difference between TD-DFT and doing DFT and then calculating a response function, because I'm just too unfamiliar with what TD-DFT can do for you.
I'm just doing it in real time, because what I'm going to argue is that saves a whole bunch of time computationally.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
And it's
being stupid, but I'm trying to figure out what extra you get from TD-DFT that you wouldn't have gotten from static DFT and perturbation theory.
Nothing. If you can do it, if you can.
You're talking about cross purposes.
No, if he calculates the response function.
And I said that, no, this is not RPA, this is time dependent on GG.
But that's just the difference in the kernel. The formulas are the same if you calculate chi by sum over states, or this is just an alternative way of doing that, calculating that response function, which is all we're interested in. And what I claim is, no.
Talking across purposes.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, anyway, so.
One more question.
Yes, sir.
The imaginary part, you say you can also get an imaginary part.
Oh, yeah, sure.
How do you do that? You get both real part and imaginary part by just doing the division? Or?
Well, chi is a function of, you have the P of T.
Fourier transform, or you simply just get both of them directly?
No, Fourier transform. I mean, you have to Fourier transform the P of T to get chi of omega.
Right. So you don't use the KK transform?
No. You just
you get it directly.
Well, I mean, they're analytic, so you just, as you calculate the Fourier transform, as you go.
Okay.
John, I don't know if you plan to discuss the computational efficiency later.
I am. I will, yes. And then you can see the scaling, how it goes. Okay, so this is applying it to some big molecule, and I can't even pronounce the organic name of this thing, but it's called YLD-156, and actually there are a couple legs of it. But we do reasonably well with the in comparing to experiment. There are some differences there, but the experiments are done in a solvent, and our calculations are done without a solvent. And so the question is, what are the solvent effects? And I'll come back to that at the end. But that gives you an idea of how well it's working or not. Okay, so how do we do this thing for nonlinear response in real time? Okay, again, this is our expansion. But when you put in the time dependence, you realize you have to keep the electric field at various different times. So the question is how to invert these equations efficiently. You can't just do a single Fourier transform because you're mixing up lots of different frequencies. But what my student did, this is Yoshi Takimoto, was to try to do the analog to how they do it for the static quantities. Okay, for the static quantities, you write an equation like this down, and then by varying the electric field, you get a nonlinear form, and you just fit that to some polynomials. Okay, so for the dynamic part, what he did was the following. He defines this time-dependent electric field as a standard functional form times an amplitude. And for this functional form, he uses a quasi-monochromatic wave. But that's fixed. And all he does is then vary the amplitude of these. And then he can get all of these quantities, chi, by just calculating this second order response and using this standard amplitude function. Okay? So I'll try to show how it works. The hope is that the nonlinear response doesn't have a lot of frequency dependence. And if it's fairly smooth, then if we use a quasi-monochromatic wave at approximately a single frequency, we can get the response near there without too much interference. So, and he played with various things. He either uses a sine, a damped sine, or a Gaussian. I think the sine has less ripple. This is what it looks like. It's not quite a delta function. It has a little bit of this overshoot. But it basically samples within 10%, plus or minus 10 to 15% of a given frequency. And then he calculates the P of T, Fourier transforms it, and can get the response function in terms of these basically integrals over our standard functional form. And they're different for second harmonic generation or optical rectification. But that's the scheme.
But you say he gets the P2s by applying ways of different amplitudes.
Right, that's what he calculates. And then he fits them by varying the electric fields. So this is what he calculates. He knows the functional form that he used, so he can calculate that denominator, and this is the response function.
It sounds like a delicate difference between large numbers.
Make the field large enough so you can see the nonlinear response. If you have the field too small, then you'll run into numerical instability. So you have to play with the field strength to get in a regime where it's starting to get nonlinear. And you don't want to go too far. Okay, but anyway, this is what it looks like, and these are the response. You can see it's definitely nonlinear for this simple molecule. Okay, now coming to your question, Rex, on the cost. So he looked at operation cost and compared it with standard TD-DFT Sternheimer methods. So I hope you did this right. Anyway, those are the factors. And here's real time. So I think this is n squared because you have occupied and unoccupied states. And here we only have occupied states. There's same basis functions. You have a certain number of time evolution steps, but again, by using these quasi-monochromatic waves, you can keep that net time integration fairly small, and so you win.
What was the difference between n evolved and n steps?
Let's see.
The number of different amplitudes or something like that.
Let's see. I think whenever you run that Crank-Nicholson, there's a certain number of steps to implement that operation. And then he has to repeat it every time step. He has to calculate S minus 1, and there's just a lot of things going on in that.
I think it's the number of time evolution steps, and each step forward involves an internal iteration of
right.
both predictor corrector.
Yeah, that's sort of what I was trying to say.
You need the potential at the midpoint.
Mm-hmm. So there's a little extra stuff there. The real savings is that for Sternheimer, you need both occupied and unoccupied states. And for this real time, you only need the occupied, in quotes, for a given time. Okay, well, here are some various results. Again, we tried small molecules first. And we compared with octopus. Angel Rubio et al.'s code. The octopus code is green, and this siesta code is red. And you see they're about 10% different. They also differ between various versions of correlation. The best correlation, we think, or supposedly, is this coupled cluster, which is down here, and the experiment's down here. But there are big error bars in the experiment. For the same reason that you have to calculate small differences. So it's reasonably accurate and agrees with other methods. This is water. And again, we're not too far from these coupled cluster results, but we agree with these other calculations. Yes?
I didn't get the difference between your results and the octopus?
The octopus uses a Cartesian grid, and we use a basis, finite basis, in siesta. Formally, they're similar, however.
They should be the same, huh?
Well, if you had infinite precision, of course.
But also, none of the comparisons you were making were the same functional, right?
Let's see. You know, I meant to check what functional they were using.
Just on this picture.
What do they say? No, this is a Dalton code. There's octopus. And I can't remember what the functional octopus uses. The star is for this reference. JChemFiz126. Yeah, I'm not sure what they use. Yeah, some of this difference could be the functional, but in other cases we actually agree fairly well. Let's see, I thought I had one where we're right on top of each other, but let's go on further. Okay. There was this question about the effect of the solvent. And so what we tried to do is look at this chloroform solvent and its hyperpolarizability. And we actually tried three different methods. We tried, we compared our method against octopus and against Gaussian. So, and what we found was that in order to get good results, you needed fairly large basis sets to capture the kind of full extent of the nonlinear response. And what we, to illustrate that, we calculated the local contributions to this hyperpolarizability density. And these are false color plots where red is negative and blue is positive, or vice versa, I can't remember. The left-hand side's Gaussians, the right-hand side's real space. And the interesting thing is that in this molecule, chloroform, the contributions from the chlorine are opposite in sign to the contributions from the HC bond. And as a result, the nonlinear response of this object, this chloroform, is very small. It has sizable linear response, but practically no nonlinear response. It's kind of inert. And in order to get good results for this, we had to be exquisitely careful. We had to go way out to make sure that we could calculate that expansion. And that was very tricky. Anyway, this illustrates this finding. For the linear quantities, you don't have to go very far. This is a kind of effective radius of the orbitals. And I think it's in atomic units. So for the linear quantities, things converge fairly rapidly. And we get the converged result at fairly small radius. Whereas for the nonlinear ones, we had to go up to these very large basis sets. And only when you get the fairly large ones do they start converging. Well, I'll skip this. So,
can I make John Watt a simple physical picture while he's saying here the linear response is very large for the system and the nonlinear is very small? What's the reason?
Well, it's because of this internal cancellation. But you have to imagine there are the chlorine response and the CH response are basically opposite to each other. They're internal dipolar fields counterbalance each other. And for the linear part, it just one of them wins. And for the nonlinear part, they almost cancel. Why that should be the case? Well, I think it's an accident, personally, but maybe a chemist can.
Well, doesn't it sort of make sense that the linear things have to add, whereas the next order, maybe it has to cancel?
Well, I don't know. Aren't the alphas additive? Don't you have to add the alphas?
Linear alphas additive.
Well, we are adding the alphas, but what if they're opposite sign?
You can't put an E field on and polarize one material in one direction and another in another direction.
Oh, I see. Right.
Polarize the same direction.
Oh, I see. You're just saying that the one's E squared, the other's E.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you. Very good. Okay. This is the curve I was looking for. This is, again, octopus versus this real time. And for this quantity, second harmonic generation, they seem to agree. So the method tends to work, and it works for very large systems. And it's nice that we are in essential agreement with octopus. We don't know which one's more efficient. We think ours is, but.
Is octopus perceptive or real time?
It's real time. Yeah, they're both real time methods. And finally, this is our molecule of interest to our experimental colleagues. And we're getting very good agreement with the experiments for this central peak in the nonlinear response of this molecule. So the whole game here is to try to develop molecules which have very good nonlinear properties. And hopefully, they will turn out to be useful in practical device applications.
How did you treat the solution?
We didn't. So, in fact, that's the next challenge, really, how to treat it. These should be a little different, but I will come to that. Okay, so...
Before you come to that, the previous thing, is there a simple picture for the resonance at 1.7 volts?
Probably. But, you know, we didn't look at it. There are tons of transitions that come into here. I'm embarrassed to say we treated this like a black box and really tried to just calculate the properties of this molecule without going into the analysis of which modes contribute. So it's just a different philosophy.
Typical case would be homologous type of star transition.
But there are lots of states.
Lots of different oscillators.
Yeah. So, okay. Anyway, there is a solvent effect here, and basically the hyperpolarizability depends on the molecule that you have, and so we tried to calculate it with a couple, chloroform being one. And along the way, that's still in progress. Now we have the tools to calculate maybe with a dozen chloroform molecules. But what we found, this is sort of goes to your talk, was that the calculations were rather sensitive to whether or not some of these solvent molecules got close to the molecule of interest. And when they did, they changed the properties a lot. So it's a kind of an active effect, large local contact effects with either methanol or chloroform. And what that shows, I see what he's doing. He's looking at various combinations here. This is my, as I said, my grad student's talk. So he tried to optimize the location of the solvent molecules when they got close. Oops. And when he did that, I mean, he got values for beta that varied all over the place. So I don't know what the message is there. Yes.
In the QMLM community, what we do usually for such spectroscopic properties in solution is that you run a molecular dynamics simulations and then you draw 50, 100, 200, 500 snaps. And then you get histograms basically of the spectroscopic properties. And you can basically check for convergence then in terms of the number of snapshots that you need. Because every single one of these is misleading, I think. You know, you have to take a proper average.
Right, I agree with that. So maybe you have to divide space into a kind of near region and then a far region. You might be able to treat the far region with dielectric methods.
Because here you basically are killed by the number of conformations that you have to consider if you do local optimizations. You know, so there are so many basically if you look at tensor molecules and so on.
Yeah, so you think this is possible, though, to do a bunch of snapshots. Okay, well, we haven't... notice that I really haven't done the MD, but I'm coming to that in the second part of the talk. And when you really have to consider the motion of the participants, then you need to do that.
Yes, I'm also a bit surprised that there... Well, not surprised, but it may be a bit fortuitous that you get 0.1 eV accuracy in the position of the band. Because motion effects are typically 0.2, 0.3 eV, and solvent effects are also of the order of 0.2, 0.3 eV, which cancels sometimes, you know, depends on the system.
So we were lucky.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. I'll take luck. But we can't rely on it. Okay, but we have developed a very efficient approach, and it is applicable to pretty large systems. And we think the accuracy is comparable to these frequency domain approaches. And it's also parallelizable. So it's a nice approach in general. Okay, so now switching gears, I'm going to come to the MD next.
John?
Yes?
You mentioned parallelizability, you can parallelize the code. But isn't it true that any time evolution method intrinsically are more limited because you have to remember the history, you cannot jump ahead in time?
Well, you can and you can't. Here's the deal. By putting in a small, how far do you have to go in time? You only have to go as far as a kind of damping time consistent with some desired frequency resolution. So then you can parallelize by doing several different starting points for the system, each one only going over a fairly small time domain. So, and lots of people are doing various techniques like that. So what you have to do is kind of coarse grain the time and go over a long enough time so that you've lost the memory, and then you can parallelize. So we're playing with techniques like that. Okay, so the second part was looking at non-equilibrium properties, where we had to, beyond the harmonic approximation, where we had to move the nuclei. And this is a case of platinum clusters. These are actually nanoclusters. They're used as catalysts. And it's on a surface of gamma alumina, which is a typical substrate. So some experimentalists that we worked with, Anatoly Frankel and Ralph Nuzzo, did some careful experiments using X-rays and for these nanoparticles, and they noticed some very funny things. They found that as you increase the temperature, the bond length inside this platinum got smaller, so negative thermal expansion. And they had funny behavior. The disorder in this cluster was much larger than ordinary platinum. Okay, so he gave me a phone call and asked whether we could understand it. So these are the effects. This is the X-ray absorption of platinum, platinum L-edge, at different temperatures. So you can see it moves around quite a bit. This is a plot of the disorder, mean square vibrational amplitude. This is platinum, this bottom curve, normal zero point. And this is the behavior in here. It's a large static disorder and then different variation with temperature. And then different behavior depending on the atmosphere, whether it's in helium or hydrogen.
Is this comparing little tiny 12 atom clusters with foils?
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Is it 12 atom cluster or is it just a little thing?
Amazingly, yes. So those are the four things, and I'll show you how we do it in a minute, and I'll talk about the cluster statistics. So our calculation is actually to do a DFT-MD run on this, and we use VASP, and we did a whole bunch of time steps, 3 femtosecond time steps, 2,500 of them. So you have to burn a little bit of computer time. And what I've shown here is the kind of time-elapsed picture of the cluster on the surface. There are two kinds of platinum atoms, by the way. The purple ones are kind of ordinary platinum. The bronze ones are slightly oxidized because they're in contact with one of the oxygens. So there's a little bit of charge transfer that comes in. And the amazing thing is that when we ran this time series, you get very large fluctuations. But the means were automatically consistent with this negative thermal expansion. It just came out. Okay, these are the experimental clusters that were used in the experiment. And they had some, they centered around 10, and then it was sort of plus or minus 5. We ran a 10-atom cluster just to, because we could handle that pretty easily. So these are the details of the calculation, you know, just using VASP. And for the X-ray absorption, we used our real space code, the FEF code that I discussed at the beginning. So, all right, let me just go through quickly some of these various points that were found. Well, it was found that in the hydrogen atmosphere, the bond lengths got longer. And that has a simple physical explanation. The hydrogen sort of weakens bonds. And so when you put a hydrogen in right there, because of some quantum mechanical reason, the bonds just get longer. That's all there is to it. And so that was easy. Negative thermal expansion. What I've shown here is the pair distribution function. At high temperature is red, low temperature is purple, cold. And again, you get this negative thermal expansion. It goes down. We don't get as much as the experiment. The experiment's twice as large, but they have a much bigger spread in cluster sizes. But it's order of magnitude. And the disorder is comparable. This is low temperature, this is high, and that's seems to be consistent. How about the changes in X-ray absorption? So what was seen is that this near-edge structure had some shifts. This shift, this peak at the beginning is called the white line for technical reasons. It was because in the old days when they used photographic film to measure absorption, it was whiter, it was more exposed because the intensity was higher. But anyway, it's still called the white line. So the white line is higher at high temperature, and there's a little bit of redshift. That redshift is indicative of charge transfer, because it means that the Fermi level, or threshold, has changed. And so what that is reflecting is the fact that at low temperature and high temperature, these little nanoclusters are change the kind of charge transfer to the surface. So you can't do it with a static model. You really need the dynamics to capture that variation. All right, well, here's another thing that we found that I thought was sort of interesting. We decided to plot the center of mass of the little nanoclusters. So we have X, Y, and Z here, and these are P1, P2. Well, let's look at these. These are three different places that you could start the nanocluster out on. Okay, what you notice is that the Z, which is the blue, doesn't change. It's sort of frozen vertically above the surface. But there is a kind of periodic variation in the X and Y. And what that means is that what these clusters are doing, they're sort of glued to the surface, and then they're kind of being batted around because of thermal activation. If they could, they'd move. But as it is, by equipartition, the kinetic energy is still given by KT for the whole cluster. So they have what I call a hindered Brownian motion or librational motion of the center of mass, and that's extremely large. In fact, I have a little movie so you can sort of see it, hopefully. So what I want you to focus on are some of these atoms, and you'll notice that they're moving around quite a bit. But after, well, you see that? It oxidized. So on the time scale of about 10 picoseconds, the electronics changes quite a bit. Some of these atoms actually go from one side to the other. These bonds actually can break. And again, on a time scale of about 10 picoseconds. So this nanocluster can actually move and will move. Yeah?
How do you prepare this aluminum surface? Why is the platinum sort of embedded into solids? How do you know that this is first?
I don't know. I just trust VASP to get the kind of local electronic structure.
But there must be a lot of different ways you could put platinum on aluminum in VASP and you would get different answers.
You would think, but I'll show you why you might not think that in a second. So that's an obvious question, though. So let me come back to it in a second. Okay. So this is another case of librational motion. That the time scales were adjusted so that if I did both at the same time, they would coincide. And this kind of so-called fluxional changes has been noticed before in small molecules. But I haven't really seen people discuss this thermal Brownian motion for nanoparticles. And it should be there. I mean, big particles should have a very large non-equilibrium part, I think, that cannot be capped non-equilibrium.
Thermal.
What? Thermal. It's thermal diffusion, but in internal motion, the internal degrees of freedom, not just skating across the surface, but as a big ball, it has to move around.
You mean non-equilibrium, you mean non-harmonic?
Well, I mean both.
Why non-equilibrium? You mean fluctuations of the internal degrees of freedom.
Right.
It's non-equilibrium.
You mean it's thermal equilibrium?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe it's thermal equilibrium, but not static equilibrium. I mean, if you had thermal equilibrium, what would you have? Maybe this is consistent with thermal equilibrium.
Yeah, okay.
It's, okay, some people use equilibrium by they get a structure out of the Cambridge database and put it on the surface. And then calculate vibrational properties about that. This is almost a liquid state, you know, it's a or pre-melted state where there's a lot of motion going on.
The problem with these small clusters is they can't say liquid solids.
Right.
Just a mess, right?
Yeah.
It's something with a lot of structure, but since it's short range.
So this addresses the question, does the substrate really matter? So this is the cluster footprint, again, time averaged. And you can see it's bouncing around a lot. And more or less samples a very wide footprint of the surface.
The reds are aluminum?
Yeah, the reds are oxygens.
And the green aluminum?
Yes. It should be turquoise. But anyway, yeah.
Does the simulation include dispersion? Dispersion interactions?
No.
It would be important, I think, between the
clusters. Well, it's only VASP.
No dispersion interactions.
Yeah, so wonder what dispersion would do. You mean between the particle and the surface?
Fundamentals, yes.
That's a good question. I mean, most of the properties happen because of the platinum-oxygen interaction at the surface. I guess you would think there'd be some van der Waals effect.
I mean, platinum
otherwise.
Pretty polarizable, that's why I ask.
Yeah, good point. Completely thrown out. So, okay. anyway, so our conclusion, though, is that this configurational real-time average, real-time approach does account for the dynamic fluctuations, both in the vibrations, the charge fluctuations, and this libration. And we think it just cannot be treated as an average structure plus small vibrations. But this kind of real-time real-time DFT-MD approach does account for the various observations, structural and spectroscopic. I haven't seen people discuss that librational motion in at the nanoscale, and I don't know why. I would think it's a very general feature. So we think you can model that fairly well with finite temperature DFT MD. And these are some of the people that did the work. Somehow are here. Yoshi Takimoto was left off by mistake. Main work was done by Fernando Vila and Yoshi Takimoto, and these are collaborators. That's chemistry, other graduate students, and this is the group who worked with us on the real-time TDDFT, support by NSF and DOE. So, thank you.
Could I ask you, going back to the first part of the talk, before we go back to the computational cost and the scaling, and you showed us those factors, if you didn't figure out why the product of the first set of factors was less or greater, was it, than the quantity of the second set?
Maybe it really... Let's see, where was it? There. I thought I can't find anything when you look for it.
Specifically because, sort of naively, I guess that it's obviously easier from a programming point of view to use a real time approach, but you might think you pay the price of higher CPU cost. You're claiming it's not only easier to program, but faster.
The question is, how many frequencies do you want to hang on to? And if you have to keep the eigenfrequencies of both the occupied and unoccupied states, I mean, that is going to cost you. So you save big there. You can keep the number of iterations small just by putting in a damping factor. If you want a just limited resolution, when we often don't care about the resolution. It's like calculating all the states to exquisite detail and then broadening them all out. You can save a whole bunch by having a technique which broadens them out to begin with. So, it's an alternative method. So when you don't need that precision in the list of states, then I claim this is advantageous. But maybe you can find cases where it isn't. In any case, you know, lots of experiments are being done now in real time. And if you really want to capture them, like these free electron lasers, I think we need techniques that look at the real time, you know, as was discussed last week. And we have to get away from some of the static functionals too. People are working on that. So this is just a step in that direction. I had my eye on trying to do calculations that would work with these free electron lasers and pulsed probes and various other things like that. So I just see the need of developing it as one of our standard tools.
In the second part, you mentioned that bond length becomes shorter in your case when you raise the temperature, and you showed that Wasmer produces that. But is there a simple qualitative explanation for this effect?
We tried very hard to come up with simple qualitative things. One way, which I think is correct, capture some of it, is more or less the way water, again, compresses when you raise the temperature. At low temperatures, this nanoparticle wants to sit on the substrate, and it's kind of confined by being commensurate with the substrate geometry. At high temperatures, it can go up a little bit more and become more of a liquid. You know, it gets away from the surface. So I think it's less constrained, and therefore.
So it's about gas phase life. So
yeah.
The gas phase structure is about the bottleneck shorter than the gas phase cluster.
Well, you know, I should do that. Okay, the other is this charge transfer effect. So it was a combination of factors that seemed to go on, but the charge transfer is important. That's really temperature sensitive, yeah.
Are you using Merman function?
We are not using Merman. We are using ground state. Well, we're not that high in temperature, we're 500 degrees. But it would be nice to use Merman functionals. When do you need Merman functionals? When you get up to 1,000 degrees? You guys, I should know this, but.
I don't know the answer for sure, but one thing that suggests that it might be interesting is platinum with the high density of states near the Fermi level is a candidate for electronic excitation playing some role at finite temperatures.
Interesting.
What was the high temperature you showed us?
573.
Yeah.
Coming back to the real-time simulations, if you really want to go and look into short pulsed or excitations, maybe with these free electron lasers, you know, I mean, there's a definite advantage having a real space grid code, because if you have a finite basis, you may lose much of the physics, you know, involving really highly excited states or even ionization. So there is a certain limitation to doing things this way.
That's right. We're restricted by the basis. So the octopus may win, you know. Well, okay, fine. This is what we had to play with. But I tend to agree with that. Well, we'll see how we can do it, how well we can do. Good point.
Another quantum chemist spends many graduate student years programming up analytic derivatives. And I think, I'm not sure now, but if it's in the public release, but in, for example, turbomole, I think you can see certain hyperpolarizabilities this way, in the sense that all the derivatives are done. You don't have to play with the field at all. It's done analytically, and you get the high order response. Isn't that, you know, going to be, you know, sort of almost by definition much faster than a real-time method where you have to vary the strength of the field?
How do they work, though? Don't they have to do some over states and then do that numerical stuff?
They're very good at that. They use resolution of the identity, and they control the costs of that extremely well.
So there's not some over states. With the derivative and blue color perturbed.
So how is it done? I mean, is it faster? I mean, I mean.
But in quantum mechanics, there's lots of operations that have to be done with all these things. Right?
Of course.
Memory and all that.
Yeah, but there.
How big a system can they handle? Let me ask you that.
I think the molecule you shot would not be a problem.
Maybe up to. Certainly 200 atoms is not
200 atoms, okay.
But I think 500 is
a week. And what's the overall computational time? Because these take a week, you know, or, you know, several days to do. Well, I mean, without, you divide it up, because each electric field can be done in parallel, and each of these tensor components can all be done in parallel. Lots of parallelization can be done. So you can boil this down to a few hours on a parallel machine.
I wouldn't guess, but we just have to run it and see what comes up.
Yeah.
Often, well, I'm trying to remember for hyperpolarizabilities, but they certainly run things overnight with, you know, several hundred atoms.
Maybe it's competitive. and we haven't gained anything. But
I think it's worth comparing.
Well, we tried to do it. I mean, the standard techniques that our colleagues were using, they couldn't get up to this size of molecule. Whereas these were doing it, and I can't remember whether they were using Hartree-Fock or what, but they were terrible results.
Maybe I thought the results on your figures, and those were probably by analytic differentiation.
Right. But those are small molecules. They were CO and H2O and things like that. That's right. That was, and I didn't think they could go to bigger ones, but, you know, I'm not an expert in those quantum chemistry techniques, so I could be wrong, completely wrong, so.
Okay, so let me remind you that starting with minute two, we have a discussion on spectroscopy for finite systems, and Kieran is going to start by talking about TDFT functions for finite systems, and I'm sure some of us would want to make connections between finite systems and infinite systems. So that's in the small seminar. So at the moment, that's continuing.